Thank you so much for joining us today at the Asian American Asian Research Institute's final Friday evening lecture series of the spring 2024 semester. I'm Diana Pan. I'm the interim executive director of the Institute. So again, I want to thank you all for joining us tonight for our conversation on this book, Sons of Chinatown, a memoir rooted in China and America by William G. Wong, also known as Bill, published by Temple University Press in March of 2024, so just a couple months ago. Sons of Chinatown is an evocative dual memoir of Bill and his father's parallel experiences in the United States. Now, copies of the book are right there, but also available for purchase tonight for $38 by cash or credit card and can be purchased after our conversation. So Bill will be joined tonight in conversation with President Frank Wu of Queens College. Now, writer and journalist William G. Wong has been a regional commentator for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and a columnist for the Oakland Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, San Francisco Examiner, and Asian Week, among other publications. He is the author of Yellow Journalist, Dispatches from Asian America, also with Temple University Press. Now please welcome Bill Wong and President Frank Wu.
Thank you, Diana, for your leadership of ARI over the past year, and we're looking forward to an exciting conversation. If you have questions as we're talking, please, we'll have time at the end. Just raise your hand, and we'll call on you. So I know Bill has a PowerPoint slideshow. I'll open with just a simple question, but allow me to say, Bill, I've looked up to you for decades before anyone else of Asian background was appearing in major newspapers. Bill was there, and when I was an aspiring journalist before I drifted off into disreputable work, I knew that Bill had paved the way, and he was someone who I was reading when I was still in college. So it's really, this is someone who, if you don't know him and you're just here, this is a legend. And really, it's just such an honor to be here. So, Bill, I'm going to start with a question. There's a term, a pejorative term, that's often used in the debates these days about control of the borders and so on, illegals. And that term doesn't quite explain the humanity of the folks who are coming, pursuing the same American dream. And you're proud to be a descendant of those who are illegal. So tell us more about that background and why that term isn't fair. It's not right.
Thank you, Frank. I want to thank you and Diana and Anthony of ARI for making time and space for us here. Before I get into the substance, Frank, I want to tell a little story about this guy. We're about 30 years apart in age, roughly.
Not that.
So I knew him when he was a punk 20-something year old. And the enduring image I have of Frank was at one of the political conventions that he and I went to under the auspices of Asian Week. I think it was like 92.
Decades ago.
Yeah. In New York, I think it was the Democratic Convention. Right. I may be wrong about the facts. Don't fact check me on that, please. But you and I roomed together because we were being sponsored by Asian Week to be at the convention. So our convention seats were way up in the balcony somewhere since we were not the New York Times. But I just remember Frank lying on the couch in our room. I think his laptop was on the floor. And he was rapping away like crazy. And I says, who is this guy? He can't stop writing. And when I read his stuff, I says, write more, because from Detroit, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Not your hotbed of Asian America. Where I come from, we are the hotbed of Asian America, the San Francisco Bay Area. So I said, this guy's got great potential. But then he did go into the higher end profession of the law and spent 10 years at Howard University, among other places. Became the dean at Hastings Law School in San Francisco, and Queens College was smart enough to pluck him from there, and he is truly one of our leading public intellectuals in our community who speaks passionately with great vision about how America can be a better country. And he incorporates his ethnicity into his vision for a better America. So, Frank, I want to thank you for what you've helped me do, too. So,
thanks. Great to be in dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to be a wonderful evening.
Right. The headline I would put on the theme of my, one of the major themes of my book is an illegal immigration success story. Now, as you just indicated, it's not exactly a compliment in our society today to be called an illegal immigrant. So I'm going to break it down. I'm going to reverse engineer the term in two parts. I'll start with illegal immigration, and then I'll get to the success story in a few minutes. Now, that's the cover of the book, which you're probably tired of seeing, and let's go to this map. I want us to broaden our lens and go back to 1848, when gold was discovered in California. Some of you may know this term, but in Chinese, in Cantonese, the term for America is Gum San. Gum meaning gold, San meaning mountain. In my dialect, it's Gim San. I do not know what the Mandarin translation is, so I'm not going to try. You may be able to tell me, Frank, because you do some Mandarin speaking. But this is obviously a map of China. Let me go here. So this is the area that in 1849, word finally got to China and other parts of the world, because as you can imagine, in 1848, they didn't have the internet. So it took months for word of some development like the discovery of gold in California to get around. And the reason this area is important is you can see in red is Hong Kong. We all kind of know that name. Just west of Hong Kong is Macau, the former Portuguese colony. And just west of that would be, I'm trying to find it here. Where is it? Oh, Taishan. Taishan is, in my dialect, Hoisan, which is where my father and mother and three older sisters were born way after the discovery of gold. But the point I'm making here is that when word got to this area of China, the people from this area, because this was the area that had the first contact with the West, especially the merchants from New England who sailed all the way to China, entered the Pearl River Delta, and they were the first contact. So the people learned of the discovery of gold roughly in 1849, and they, among many other people, including people on the populated West Coast, East Coast of the United States. Remember, the West Coast was not populated, did not have statehood at the time. So the beginnings of Chinese immigration in significant numbers started in this area, went east to California, and that began the story of Chinese America, later slash Asian America, in the 1850s. The reception to the Chinese miners was mostly hostile, led to the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, roughly 30 years after the discovery of gold. And that sort of began the illegal immigration schemes that the Chinese migrants and their organizations that were built around Chinatowns, that were the refuges for the Chinese miners and other people. Now, going back to Toishan, this photo was taken in 1994. This is my father's house. Members of my family, the two of the three sisters who were born there, another sister, two brothers-in-law, two nieces, one nephew, and I think the sister of one of the brothers-in-law. We were all gathered in Canton, Guangzhou, made the van trip to find the village. Took us 4 hours because among all of us, we had different but similar desire to find out where our clan leader, my father, was from. Because we had a lot of stories that he or our mother told or didn't tell, but there were certain mysteries about the way they got into America, which again goes back to the term illegal. They came in, both of them came in as paper. My father was a paper son. My mother was a paper daughter. And I'm going to get into some details that are quite confusing and convoluted, but that was the nature of what Chinese immigrants at the time had to do to get around the restrictions of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which in general banned Chinese laborers as because the white labor force was against the Chinese labor force in America at that time. And just a historical side note, in the 1860s, right around the time at the end of the Civil War, these four men, landowners, very powerful men, decided to finish the Transcontinental Railroad, and the route from the east were built mainly by Irish laborers, and from California to Utah were Chinese laborers. But after that came a recession. The Chinese laborers were considered expendable, and that began the anti-Chinese feelings that led to the Chinese Exclusion Act. So from that point on, the Chinese organizations that had set up in Chinatown had to find a way to get around the exclusion law. And the scheme that is well known within our community was the paper son scheme. And this is how it worked. There would be a sponsor who had to have been a native of America. So you say, wow, there were some Chinese people born in, let's say, California, San Francisco. In 1870, there was a man named G. Bing Fong. I'll call him GBF. He said he was born in San Francisco in 1870, went to China in 1876 when he was 6 years old with his parents to China, came back in 1890 when he's 20 years old. But when he got back to the port of San Francisco, I think it was the ship's captain or somebody said, no, you can't come in. This was right after the Chinese Exclusion Act had been passed. And he said, you are a subject of the Emperor of China. But GBF said, no, I was born in San Francisco in 1870. So there became an immediate legal dispute. And he and the Chinese organization supporting him, and this is my speculation, hired a sympathetic white attorney to bring up the case in a U.S. district court in San Francisco. And I say this not because I'm guessing. I have the paperwork of the 1890 case that the U.S. district judge in San Francisco basically believed GBF that he was born in San Francisco. The paperwork does not give any paper evidence. So you can say, wow, did GBF get lucky? But I'm also told by legal experts of that time that many of the cases that went before U.S. district courts in that time period who claimed they were born in San Francisco won their cases, which was pretty darn amazing, if you ask me. So therefore, GBF became a native of America. Therefore, he could then legally bring in his children. But his children were listed on a document, and my father, who was not directly related to GBF, was paper son number two. I'll fast forward to my mother, who came over decades later. She was the only girl listed in this list of seven as the only girl. So there was my father and my mother as paper brother and sister. I told you it's confusing, so don't. And I'm not going to give you a quiz after this because I have problems understanding this. But this was the way that the Chinatown communities and their organizational leaders came about to, my term is, express a, this was their expression of civil disobedience to an unjust and illegal American law, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which I thought was pretty smart. So this was how numerous Chinese immigrants using false papers got into the country legally. So, and I bring this up because the term illegal is, now I'm not advocating anybody break the law. Please don't, you know, don't quote me as, because I don't want to go to prison myself, having said that. But I want us to think about how people even today who are desperately coming to, trying to get into America may not have the proper papers. What I want to raise is the idea that let's talk about America now, just in the big picture. Shouldn't we be proud that our country remains a place, maybe the number one place, that people from all over the world who either don't have the means to or don't want to wait to get the proper documentation, because that process takes a long time, they are desperate enough to find their way in without proper documentation and or who overstay a visitor's visa or whatever. So that's the question I want to raise on a philosophic basis, not on a legal basis, because Frank's colleagues might get after us for breaking the law. So back to my father and mother being brother and sisters. It is a family legend that my father came in 1912 when he was a... that's again another picture of the village, and that can tell you the sort of very rural conditions. And here's a water buffalo that we found out when we were in the village in 1994, looking through the opening of that plastic sheet. We saw a heap of, you know, stuff on the ground. And the villagers told us, well, that's where the water buffalo now rests at night. Anyway, here is the entry document of my father. He was, again, a mid-teenager, and there's a date up here somewhere that shows 1912. Yeah, right there. He was about 17 years old, so he came in as a son of a native. And therefore, in the son of a native category was a legal category to get around the banning of Chinese laborers. Another category was merchants, diplomats, and I think students. So there was a small group of Chinese that were able to legally get in, and my father happened to be one of those who was able to do that. And here he is as a late teen, early 20s. He settled in Oakland, California, because people from his region and his clan had already settled in Oakland. So that's a familiar immigrant trend. You go where you know people, and they would be able to provide for you, help you find work, and ease your entry into this foreign country, which in some cases were officially hostile to you. He went to Lincoln School, which is the, quote, American school that served Chinatown kids. Many decades later, my sisters and I went to Lincoln School also. He learned English because he didn't know any English when he got here. In 1919, I think by pre-arrangement with his mother in China, he decided to go back to marry, because there were very few Chinese women in the day who were candidates for marriage, and interracial marriage was completely off the books because those were the days. So in 1919, he went back to get married. He and his first wife had a daughter, and his first wife died, and a second woman from the same nearby village of a different clan. My father came from the Ji clan, or in Mandarin it's Zhu. That's another complication, folks. The English spelling of Chinese words is don't go there, okay? Zhu or Ji or Zhu. That's a third way of pronouncing the same Chinese word. She came from the Yi village. Then she gave birth to two more daughters through about the early 1930s. So my father was back and forth between Oakland and his village. And I later found out through my own personal research that he started a business in the village area as an agent to help other Chinese do what he had done a decade or two before. So he found a way of being entrepreneurial about getting Chinese migrants into America through perhaps the same crooked path that he took and that he brought his family over. Now, this is a picture of my father at Lincoln School, and you see that arrow up there, that's him in Western dress. My guess was 1913. He was late teens, okay? But look at how this was a range of children in his class, Lincoln School, the great Americanization institution in Oakland, Chinatown. And here he is as a man, I estimate this was in the 1930s, because as a man who left his village to come to America, that was a big deal in his village. And there was a term in the dialect that indicated that he was a man to be respected, because what he did, as many other Chinese men in his situation, would be to send money back that he earned, his little nuggets of gold, metaphorically, that he found in Oakland Chinatown. He sent some of that back to his wife, my future mother, and she became popular in the village because, number one, she didn't have to work as hard in the fields, and she was able to share some of the goodies that he sent back. So both my mother and father were very popular in the village thanks to this dynamic that was at work. But when he went back, I'm told by one of my older sisters who remembers the case, he would dress up in this fancy suit and maybe even be brought into the village in on a pedestal with some people carrying him. So it was a big deal. So there was status that he had achieved by going to America. And here's my mother. One of her early immigration photos. Let me get to her story. My father's second wife, who in the village married, had two daughters. So when my father decided to bring her, his three daughters, two of whom were hers, in 1933, there was no specific law that I could find that said Chinese men who were legally in the country in the United States could not bring a wife, but that was certainly the understanding. And I still have to do some more research myself to see whether there was a specific bar on wives coming in. But remember what I said about GBF in 1890 or 1900, listing seven children, six sons, one daughter. My mother was that seventh child, the only daughter. So somehow my father and or his elders said to GBF, we'll buy slot number two and slot number seven. So my father and mother had to say, well, when we get to Angel Island, which I will show in a second, which was the processing center for people coming into America from Asia at the time in the early 1900s, we have to tell them that your brother and sister, not husband and wife, all right? So they managed to get through that way. So officially, according to the U.S. government, my father and mother were brother and sister. Okay, what happens next? What do I have here? There's another photo of my mother, one of her documents. Oh, there's me, but let's pause there for a second. I don't want to talk about myself just yet. So let's do a little time thing. She came, my mother, my three older sisters, arrived in Oakland, Chinatown in November of 1933. In early 1934, it was apparent that she was pregnant. All right, scandal. How could a single Chinese woman be pregnant? Scandal. Maybe it's not a scandal today, but it was a scandal in 1934. So, what did my mother and father and maybe their elder advisors in the associations and tongs say? Let's find a man to whom we'll pay to, quote, marry my mother on paper. And I have the, I don't know whether I have it here. Let me see whether I do. I don't have it here. Sorry. I have the paper from the Alameda County office that gives out marriage licenses. There's a man named Wong Sheng, W-O-N-G-S-H-E-N-G. His surname is Wong, marrying my mother, who was listed as a G. He was 42. She was in her late 20s. So on paper, my mother is legally married, which legitimizes the birth in September of my sister Nellie in 1934. And in matter of fact, Nellie is still alive and well, living in San Francisco, a well-known poet and political activist. But when Nellie came along in September of 1934, her birth became legitimate and she took the Wong surname. So on paper, she's a Wong. In Chinatown, she's a G. All right? I told you this is confusing. 1936, 1938, and then in 1941, I came along. A side story, and I'm not being revealing about Chinese culture in this regard, or maybe I am. Huge patriarchy, a favor boys over girls, which for the women in this crowd, whether you're of Chinese descent or not, is not new to you. And it's not just Chinese culture that favors patriarchy. We know that it's a dominant theme in many other cultures. But let's stop there because I don't want to get into a gender politics argument with any of you here. But baby boy Bill was desired by my parents, and here they had six girls, right? And I will reveal this because I talk about it in my book. My parents were not very happy with each girl that came along. They were especially tough on the second girl and then the sixth girl. But all of them were subject to some degree of mental abuse. But they wanted me all along. I didn't know that, you know, I just came along because it happened, right? One of those miracles of humanity. So the four children born in Oakland, three older sisters and me, were all named Wong, which is why I, as a professional writer, I always wrote under either Bill Wong or William Wong. And I'll explain in a minute why I added G. So that was the story of the illegal part. Let me get to the last two words, success story. Overall, I'm writing a book that I think will show people that immigration works, even if it is under some questionable illegal circumstances. And it is part of the big picture that some of us would like to embrace called the American dream, that we are a nation of immigrants. America welcomes immigrants from all over the world. We have opportunities to put aside the misery that we knew at home, an opportunity to have a better life. It is a wonderful American story, and I know that we need to embrace that story endlessly because, as I said earlier, we still remain a country, a society that is seen as a place where people will have second, third, and fourth opportunities to have a better life. So overall, my story is an illegal immigration success story. So that wraps up in too many words the theme.
No, that's fantastic. I'll add two footnotes, and then we'll turn to Vice. All right, so and maybe you could comment on this. My understanding is the 1906 earthquake, which was terrible,
right,
had a benefit for Chinese because it destroyed the records. Did that help your family?
That is a good question. I've looked into the question. It's true, 1906 earthquake hit San Francisco, the worst big fires, whatever records were in City Hall at the time were destroyed. I have looked into the question, not real deeply, as to what the nature of birth certificates in general were. And I was unable to find out with any precision as to whether these claims of the 1870 births of Chinese men mostly, were they in City Hall that burned down? My suspicion is that maybe there were, which then for these Chinese organizations that were trying to get around the restrictions of the Chinese Exclusion Act said, whoa, what a great opportunity.
Right. No more paper.
No more paper. So let's create this paper son, paper daughter scheme, which as a requirement were coaching books that were basically guides unique to each person's circumstances, where an interesting mix of fact and fiction were created to tell family stories, village stories, historical stories that the paper father sponsored would need to tell the same story that his paper sons mostly and the paper daughter would have to tell. So these coaching books needed to be created And I still wonder, man, that what an industry that was, by all these organizations and very creative minds among the Chinatown people to put some facts in there, like, you know, and the incredible mundane nature of the questions, 200-300 questions per interrogation session were things like, how many steps in your house that led to the front door? How many windows and what kind of windows were on the west side? Who were your neighbors three doors down and two rows up? Could you do that now in your neighborhood? Right, come on, give me a break. But it was that nature, but the people who wanted to come in under a paper sponsor needed to be in line with what the paper sponsor said. So that really required a great deal of study by somewhat illiterate people. So there had to be training, reading the coaching books, making sure they didn't have the coaching books when they went to Angel Island. So there was a whole... I don't know how they did it, to be honest with you. So the earthquake did certainly, and the fire had a lot of benefits because it did enhance the opportunity for Chinatown people to come up with these wonderful half-true, half-fake stories that got people in under legal categories.
Right, yeah. Right. They had their own papers.
Right.
So I'll just add a quick note and then we'll turn to Vice. And many of the white miners and others who fought against the Chinese were themselves immigrants. They were from Europe. They were recent arrivals, too.
There you go. Okay. Yeah.
So let's talk about Vice, and so that no one gets the wrong idea. This is a great story. It runs all throughout the book. I just love this background, and as a lawyer, I can say the statute of limitations is long past. You can say anything you want. Talk to us about gambling and the numbers racket and Oakland and your family, because, as you put it, it drove the economy.
Exactly right.
Gambling.
So in,
all right.
In either listening to family stories or remembering what my mother told my sisters, because I came along a little later than my father's gambling hobby, sideline business. So I looked into what did Pop, I call him Pop, what did he do in the his first years when he was going to Lincoln? He was worked in an herb shop, learned how to prescribe herbal medicines for, he lived and worked there. When he, in the 1920s, when he was going back and forth, we know, again, through family legend, that he drove a vegetable truck around the area and sold produce that were grown by other Chinese farmers in the region. And he would go to the University of California, Berkeley campus, for example, to sell produce to the fraternities and sororities whose chefs and cooks were Chinese immigrants. Then in the 1930s, in the teeth of the Depression, he, we learned, was a lottery broker, all right? In the lottery business, which was illegal at the time, and the lottery business in Chinatown throughout California have existed since the 1800s. But in the time that I studied about the Chinese lottery, it was illegal. It was driven by Chinatown merchants like my father, and each of them operated this way. My father in the 1930s had a storefront at exactly the same place where you see the restaurant sign, and I'll get to the restaurant in a minute or two. So right there was a grocery store in the front, so-called grocery store. It's a legal business. But there were a few rooms behind the grocery store, one of which was the bedroom of my parents, another bedroom for my sisters. the third room in the back was where people really wanted to go. And the customers who went into the grocery store were a mixed bag. Chinatown people, white people, other Asians like Filipinos, Japanese, Koreans, and some black people. A few that lived in and around Chinatown. They would head past this, you know, dusty bin of old oranges and whatever, head to the back where my father, my mother, who was just a new immigrant herself, my, at that time, 7-year-old number two sister who had just come from China, and maybe a G cousin were back there with their paper tickets. I'm sorry I don't have an image of it on this slideshow, but there were lottery tickets as we see them today with the numbers 1 through 80, Powerball or whatever. I don't play the game, but as we know, lottery is completely legal. You're encouraged to buy lottery tickets. Let me tell you, it goes back to the Chinatown illegal lotteries, which had, instead of 1 to 80, had Chinese words, none of which repeated themselves. And Janie, you may know, correct me if I'm wrong, they were the first 80 words of a classical Chinese poem. I think it's called the 1,000-character classic or something like that. That apparently, if you were growing up in China, you would need to study and learn. And they were in rhyming couplets or whatever. And what I was told, since I don't read Chinese, that the fact that none of the words repeats itself was great, because then the bettors, the people who went to these shops like my father's, would, like, if you play now, I guess it's computerized, so you can choose any number of the words. But in the days, most favored bets were either 9-spot or 10-spot. And some of the Chinese language readers and people familiar with the poem might choose 4 words that meant something to them spiritually. But other people who didn't read, they would just circle, you know, however people bet. So these tickets were widely bought within Chinatown, as Frank mentioned, and my research validates. The gambling industry in general and the lottery tickets in particular were the economic driving force in Chinatowns, especially during Depression. Almost every other storefront was a legal business in front, the lottery in back. And the Oakland power establishment, in other words, the politicians, the mayor's office, the city council, and the police establishment, the chiefs and their deputies and the beat cops, all knew about this. They all knew that Chinatown had illegal gambling operations. So, what did they do? Well, they staged raids. But here is one descendant of one of the lottery shop owners that I interviewed before he passed away, said to me. He said, my dad would be alerted to a raid maybe the next day or whenever it was coming by a beat cop. Oh, by the way, you know, you're going to be raided, or words to that effect. So his dad and his workers said, okay, we'll take down this new door, the good door. We'll put up a bad door, because when the cops came down with their axes, they would destroy the bad door. So in other words, it was a game. The cops knew the gambling establishment from the retailer level up to the bosses knew that the police and the political establishment in Oakland had to go through this exercise, because then they would get an article in the Oakland Tribune or the Post-Inquirer, Oakland cops raids, you know, lottery shop. and they'd get two or three paragraphs, and maybe the citizenry would clap and say, oh, the police are doing their job. But we know what comes next. There was this, right? On a regular basis, there were bribery, either in the form of money itself, or in the case of one guy told me, well, he says, my dad would give police and politicians a card which said something, and you can bring the card to this particular grocery store or fish shop, hand it to the clerk there or the, you know, the sales staff, and they would give you some food, a turkey, some fish, whatever. So the bribery would go on, and I know this because I did my journalistic research. I went to newspaperarchives.com, a website, paid my money, which gave me access to a number of American newspapers that are digitized. I found the Oakland Tribune. I put into the search engine, and believe me, I'm not very tech savvy. And as a side note, I want to pay tribute to my wonderful son, Sam, who, if he weren't helping me with finding this website, I would be talking endlessly without pictures. So thank you, Sam. But anyway, I was interested in finding whatever articles the Oakland Tribune wrote. So I put into the search engine Chinatown lotteries. Up popped almost 300 entries of and headlines. So I said, oh boy, do I have to go through all 300? And I said, yeah. But a lot of them were these raids. But a whole bunch of them were about police corruption. And the banner year to me was 1919, when interesting stories about one former police chief accusing a current police chief of being corrupt. All right? And they named Chinatown gambling bosses by name. I said, oh my God. And so it was so open at the time. And besides which, the Oakland City Hall got extra money from the raids and the shutdown of gambling establishments because there were fines and there were penalties and all that stuff. So some of the politicians didn't want to stop the raids because, you know, there was extra revenue involved. But by the early 1950s, the U.S. government put a tax on basically Chinese gambling. So I still wonder to this day how lottery became so popular. Anyway.
I'll bet you could still find some of those back rooms if you went and looked.
As a matter of fact, I know where they are.
You do? All right. Bill, I know you've also thought a lot about the differences in Chinatowns.
Yeah.
Oakland Chinatown is not the same as San Francisco. It's not the same as Manhattan.
Right.
And on the East Coast, you spend a lot of time on the East Coast, too.
Right.
It's entirely different. Talk to us a little bit about the regional differences you see. Even in the Bay Area,
right.
Oakland, San Francisco, Chinatown is totally different.
Right.
Had a little bit of a rivalry, maybe
right,
some antagonism.
Right, right. Yeah.
And then we're seeing change. Talk to us about time
and how
new immigrants are creating different Chinatowns and maybe have, I don't want to generalize, but different attitudes. They're coming at a different point in U.S. history, U.S.-China history.
Yeah. Well, in general, the California Chinatowns were of the same, but not the same, era, dating back to the exclusion era leading into the early 20th century, coming generally from the region that I pointed out near Hong Kong, just west of Hong Kong. Now, in fact, the Chinatown, the mother of all Chinatowns is San Francisco because that's where the Chinese gold seekers first and then the railroad workers and then after that people who came. They had to come through San Francisco and then later the Angel Island Immigration Station in San Francisco Bay was the enforcement arm of the U.S. government. Oakland became kind of one of the main secondary Chinatown, and some people ventured just the short trip across San Francisco Bay. But in fact, there were both differences, because San Francisco Chinatown developed this very complex, thick infrastructure of Chinese organizations, of clan family, region, and the notorious Tongs. And membership were mostly men, all men. There were cross memberships, cross rivalries, friendships, alliances, and rivalries. And therefore, and you know, there were some Tong wars, of which my father was partially threatened by some, very complex relationships within the Tongs, a lot of secrecies, dating all the way back several centuries to the Southeast China region. But in general, that era was, to me, the first generation of, let's say, 20th century Chinatowns. Now, the Chinatowns on the East Coast, either Boston, Chicago, Philly, New York, were about a generation behind. And whether the people came only from that greater Hong Kong area, I don't think was true, because other migrants from nearby areas in Southeast China went either, again, through the Pacific or had more circuitous routes that finally went over the Atlantic and went through Ellis Island. So my understanding is it was kind of a second plus generation of Chinatowns. But what I like to make a distinction is that there are basically, in my imagination, two Asian Americas. The one that traced its roots to the gold rush to World War II, about 100 years, which involved the two types of Chinatowns I just mentioned. Then there was that short period after the communist victory in 1949, where there was some immigration loosening to bring in the Chinese of the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party that had lost the Civil War that went to Taiwan, bring some of them into America in smaller numbers. And then the big immigration change in 1965 that equalized worldwide quotas for immigrants from everywhere. And then 1975, the end of the Vietnam War. The 65 and 75 changes really exploded the demographic changes. And a math figure I like to use is in 1970, the totality of the Asian American population, mainly of Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, and some South Asian, well below 1% of the American population. And again, as a many side notes I make to myself, which I will share with you, I do wonder why Congress in the 1800s would name the Chinese as the only group they wanted not to be here, when our numbers, or the numbers of my elders, were so teeny. Very small numbers. Why? Anyway, and then, but again, after 65 and 75, the explosion of ethnic Chinese from Southeast Asia, maybe some from the Caribbean, a lot of Chinese from Taiwan, a lot from Hong Kong, and other regions of China, and I'm not revealing a secret here. China is a very large country with a lot of people of so many different backgrounds, dialects, that finally, over the last 50 plus years, we're seeing more representation from those groups. And maybe some of you, including yourself, Frank, have a more recent immigration history. But one of the reasons I wanted to write this story as my family story, as a representation
of an era that a lot of Americans, including Chinese Americans today, and other Asian Americans, don't have a clue about, because I wanted to document the life story as best as I could, recreate it, of my father as one immigrant who came in as a paper son, who had to lie officially to get in, but who was able to, through all the hardships that he has as a typical immigrant, was able to grow a family of four generations, of 40-some-odd people, of either full Chinese ethnicity or a mixture of many different ethnicities, which to me then raises the question of, isn't it wonderful that our country is able to, at least on the positive end, have people who are creating a new group of people who are not bound by the traditions, whether of Chinese, other Asian, European, African, Latino descent, because that to me remains the great challenge for our country. And I'm not going to get into a heavy-duty thing about the current political environment, but to me we have to start looking at the future of who we are as a country and who is an American and who belongs here and who doesn't.
So I think we have time for a question or maybe two from the audience, if anyone has a question. And if not, I'll offer another to help Bill continue his stories.
Can you speak a little bit about the younger generation of Chinese that, you know, were born and lived in Chinatown, and how are they, are they staying in Chinatown? Are they...
Yeah, Bill, tell us about Oakland Chinatown today.
Yeah.
What's happened to all these shops, the gambling operation, the fish market, and so on?
There are still some storefronts. Let me just point out this picture, which is what I didn't talk about. From 1943 to 1961, my parents ran the Great China Chop Suey House.
Oh, that's your family restaurant.
That's our family restaurant. Photo taken 1958. That was the storefront where my sisters and I worked, were family business. The storefront today is still there, 723 Webster Street, Oakland, Chinatown. It is today a wonderful, healthy Cantonese, mainly chicken noodles, chicken soup place that has other authentic, but it is maybe the 10th iteration.
Bill?
So there are some storefronts that are the same, and some obviously they have a change. Go ahead.
Bill, is that the Oakland Tribune
that
building? Your life story.
That is my that's my story about getting into the American mainstream, which is the so-called success story of achieving the American dream. So here you see Chinatown. In the background is the Oakland Tribune, which is the tower of the leading American newspaper that for generations existed as the main form of local communications before the internet. So I knew the Tribune from the time I was a kid, because I read the sports pages.
And it's only a few blocks.
Only a few blocks. Let me just give you the number. 13th and Franklin, this is Webster and 8th. And Franklin is the next street over. So 6-8 block, easy walk, healthy walk. It's been always there. So when I became a regular mainstream journalist, being one of the few of my background entering what then was a white male-dominated industry, which again is no secret to many of you here, I was kind of amazed that here I was working for this towering institution in Oakland, and I come from that spot, and able then to begin to tell stories from my community to the readers of the Oakland Tribune. So my little contribution to expanding the knowledge base of the Oakland Tribune leadership was to write about stories that came from here. Now, as for this building was a major Oakland gambling house in the basement. You wouldn't know it, but police knew it. Chinatown knew it. So there were all these secrets and facades.
So it was Chinese owned, you mean?
Pardon me?
The pool hall was Chinese?
The pool hall was, certainly. Yeah. And then all these businesses along Webster, which is the main drag in Oakland Chinatown still, but this building itself was owned by within Chinatown, one of the biggest gambling bosses. And I even interviewed his son, and when I interviewed him, he was already in his 90s, a successful man living on the San Francisco Peninsula near Silicon Valley. And he said, "Bill, I didn't know my father's business. He was either telling me that or didn't want to be bothered with a nosy reporter." So I accepted that because, again, the gambling business was one of those secret businesses that the men who ran it at the time didn't want to talk. But back to this, COVID, the pandemic, hurt Oakland Chinatown badly, the way it hurt many other businesses. Again, that's no secret. So there have been some businesses who have to close. There have been anti-Asian incidents in Chinatown, which really distresses me a great deal. Now, as to whether it still has families, but when I go to Chinatown, I still hear my native dialect from elderly Chinese who don't speak English, who are selling goods on the street. And because my dialect is very minimal now, I'm unable to really get into their stories. But it just reminds me that Oakland Chinatown remains a refuge for people who don't feel that they are part of the American mainstream.
So, Bill, what type of gambling is there? I'm just curious, besides the lottery?
There was Mahjong, which is recreational. There was Pai Gao. And there may have been a third game. But back to the perceptions. In Chinatown, these weren't considered illegal activities. They were simply games that were played within the community for recreation.
But money changed hands.
Oh, money changed hands.
Serious money.
Serious money. Right. Or in the case of the lottery, for example, which I did more research on, the kind of bets that were bought or that were offered to my father and other brokers were nickels and dimes. That was the currency in the day. A few people might bet 50 cents or a quarter or even a dollar. Right?
So, but what a dollar then would be maybe $5 now?
I don't know the inflation, maybe even more.
Yeah, maybe $10.
Even more. But there was, my book explains in some detail about the sort of financial configurations of different types of bets, and my father got into trouble with something that he did and almost didn't make it, so... You have to read the book to get to that chapter.
We have one last question.
Three questions online.
Oh, okay. All right. So how about if you read them all, and we'll have Bill take them all together.
Sure. How did your family's business handle gambleholics? Were there any people who lost their shirt and everything?
Wow.
Did you know growing up that your parents were paper sons and daughters? And also, how did the University of California enter your story?
Oh. Okay. Did you hear all those?
Gambleholics, right?
Yeah.
There was nothing that I could say from direct knowledge that there was concerns among the brokers, like my father and the bosses, that some people went out of their minds. There was one or two anecdotes that my one of my older sisters remember my mother telling that. Sometimes these big gamblers or people who love to gamble were so mad that they lost that they would come to our restaurants order dinner or coffee and pie and would be screaming like crazy. So it wasn't a matter of there was an awareness among the Chinatown gambling industry that they would try to help the gambling. As we know now in the very fine print on all these gambling ads that we all see, you know, if you've got a problem, call 1-800 and don't do it if you... None of that. So to that question, number two was...
Did you know your parents were paper sons? And
yes, my sisters and I, over the years, would bore one another and or people who listened to us do family talk. And we would know, and I'll use the dialect term, in Hoi San Hua, my native dialect, we would use the term Hu Ji Doi, which literally means get paper boy or paper son. So we knew the concept was there. None of us, until I got deep into my own research, knew the intricacies and the details that I write about in my book. But let me say there was an interim period when I found out that the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, which, by the way, is an agency that a certain former president and would-be future president has had a lot of trouble with, but it is the U.S. agency that stores any number of documents that the U.S. government generates. NARA opened a regional office just south of San Francisco, I would estimate maybe 30 years ago. So the Chinatown gossip had it, oh, by the way, there is this agency that's south of San Francisco that has records of the Angel Island immigration experience. So I said, I seem to remember Angel Island, my father and mother going through there, but again, without any detail. So I decided to go there, and a very helpful archivist was able to help me find the entry papers, the transcriptions of all the interrogations of my father on four different entries and exits, because the requirement, if you had to leave, you had to get permission. When they came back in, they had to be questioned again. And then in 1933, when my future mother, the so-called sister of my father, and three China-born sisters, they were also interrogated. Their records were there. So all of that was before I did my heavy research. So yes, I knew in general terms, but didn't know in the detail that I write about in my book. The third question was?
How did the University of California enter your story?
Oh, boy. Cal has always been, to my generation of Chinatown kids and generations before, the go-to college. Two of my sisters went to Cal before me, and one of them went in the mid-1940s. And already Cal had a number of Chinese-American students, so it was known as the institution. And the reason is Berkeley, which is the town where the University of California campus is 5 miles from here. Now, of course, 5 miles you don't walk. You need to have some, and public transportation will get you there, or if you drove, you could get there fairly easily. So it was almost like the neighborhood college, right? And we didn't think about its reputation then or even now, and it astounds me that our neighborhood college was the University of California at Berkeley. And my naivete, which I reflect in the book, was that, my number two sister and number six sister both went there. The number six sister went there in the 1950s. So, but I was the only one that my parents wanted to go to college. So, to the chagrin of my sisters, and here is where the patriarchy comes in and the spoiled brat title I'm entitled to comes in. They had started a savings account for me to pay for college education. For the two sisters I talked about, they didn't get help from my parents to pay for the very small fees that Cal charged in those days. So Cal has always been a part of our family's aspirations to better our lives through education, as well as the Northern California Chinese American community. We always knew that was the place to go. I confess in my book that I had never heard of, and maybe I have a bad memory, never heard of the Ivy League, never heard of Yale and Harvard and Columbia, Princeton, and all these great elite institutions, because at the time I was thinking about going to college, I said, maybe the University of Oregon, because by that time I had an interest in journalism, and the gossip was that the University of Oregon had a good journalism school. But here was Cal, and one of my journalism teachers at high school said, Bill, you should think about going to Cal. And my grade point average was pretty good, but I wouldn't be able to get into a community college these days with my GPA. So kids today are blessedly smarter and have to work a lot harder to get in. But Cal has always been part of my life. Now, we did hear about Stanford a little bit. And my lovely daughter-in-law, who's in the crowd, is a proud graduate of Stanford generations later. But when I was growing up, we heard about Stanford. But what we heard about Stanford was that it's a wealthy school that charges a lot of money. And a Chinatown guy slightly older than me, we knew, went to Stanford. So when I interviewed him, because he was also part of a gambling family, I asked, hey, George, when you went to Stanford a few years before I went to Cal, how did you do it? What, I mean, your family, they were wealthier than us. And I asked him, how could you pay whatever Stanford was charging? He says, well, it was $300 either a year or a semester. Cal was charging, in my early days or one of my sister's days, $27.57 a semester. So I don't want to make some of you who have children going to college cry, but we are living in much different times.
Right. Well, another big round of applause for Bill and his terrific stories.
So thank you, Bill and President Wu, for this wonderful conversation this evening. And as President Wu said, the book is available for sale, which we can buy tonight, or online from the Temple University press site. That's through the Talks webpage, where you probably saw advertised. So with that, enjoy the rest of your Friday and have a lovely summer, and we'll see you in the fall. Good night.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.